Well, good afternoon, my friends. Good afternoon, friends and listeners. This is Jim Lafferty, co-host along with my dear friend, attorney Maria Hall, bringing you this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. And it's a good edition. I urge you to stay tuned. I think you will learn a lot. You know, this show, this station, this network, of course, is committed during this next period ahead, which could be a bumpy ride, to work harder than ever to cut through the crap, cut through the BS, and to bring you the truth about what is going on and what you can do to make it better. So, Maria, starting this off, what are we going to talk about today that'll help people?
Yes, well, today we'll be speaking with two very special guests. In our first half hour, we'll be joined by longtime environmental justice advocate Angelo Logan about the ongoing struggle to achieve environmental and climate justice locally and nationally. Then in our second half hour, legal scholar and writer Marjorie Kahn will join us to talk about Trump, the military and political dissent, and about the federal laws that are meant to protect we the people from abuse of government power.
Well, yes, it does. It's going to be critically important, both of those issues, certainly in the Trump administration. So let's get going.
All right, let me start us off. This half hour, we'll be talking about the environment through the lens of justice and fairness and how they are so deeply connected. Many fear that whatever progress we've made as a country on both the environmental and justice fronts will be in jeopardy with Trump back in office. But I'd like to challenge you to see that there are silver linings. Those silver linings are in the form of groups and people who have been in the environmental and climate justice struggle for decades and have made it known that they're not only ready for the battle of their lives, but are ready for you to join them. As just one example, after the election, the Center for Biological Diversity promised, quote, an all-out effort to protect the climate, wildlife, and wild places, and they remind us this country's bedrock environmental laws stand strong. We're more prepared than ever to block the disastrous Trump policies we know are coming. Now, I don't want to discount the very real dangers we're facing. However, this half hour is about those who've been fighting to protect environmental and climate justice every day, no matter who is in power. And these are the ones who stand ready to take center stage to confront the challenges ahead. And today is about encouraging you to plug in and be a force for change from where you sit right now. Giving up is not an option. With all of that in mind, I'm so happy to introduce you to someone whose career I've followed for decades, Angelo Logan. He's the Senior Director of Environmental and Climate Justice for Liberty Hill Foundation. Angelo started as an organizer way back in 2000 at my alma mater, Communities for a Better Environment. He then went on to co-found East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice. And since then, he's served on too many coalitions and advisory panels to list here. And he's also been sought after for his expertise on environmental justice by government agencies, including the South Coast Air Quality Management District and the EPA, and perhaps his highest profile role, serving on the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Angelo Logan, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure being here. And thank you, Jim, for, you know, all your work on this show as well. It's really a pleasure to be here and an honor. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, our pleasure. So to start off with, let's start with some basics. When we talk about the word environmentalism, that can mean so many different things. What does it mean to practice environmentalism through a lens of environmental justice and climate justice? How are those terms generally defined out there, and what do they mean to you personally?
Well, you're right. It's a complex term, and it means many different things to many people. I'll say that the term has also changed over time with, you know, a variety of folks that have been working in the field. But, you know, the environment in terms of environmentalism is really about the natural environment and, you know, folks that are environmentalists or, you know, identify as environmentalists are generally folks that would look at the natural environment without kind of thinking about the people that are involved in the environment itself. You know, looking at environmental justice, or, you know, that kind of environmentalism through environmental justice lens, really is about, you know, centering people, and specifically looking at the disparities and the burdens that specific communities face when there are environmental burdens and environmental issues. So, you know, we know absolutely that working class, working poor communities of color, tribes and indigenous people carry the burden of environmental degradation and have more environmental health impacts due to the environment, whether that's, you know, living near a freeway or living near a power plant or next to a chemical plant, or, you know, living on top of soil that has been contaminated for years from a variety of things that have happened. We know that placing and siting toxic facilities tends to happen in working class, working poor communities of color. And when we work towards environmental justice, we're really trying to resolve the issues around that and really addressing it from that standpoint. In terms of climate justice, we know that the climate crisis starts in our neighborhoods. And if we're going to address the climate crisis, we got to address the issues in our neighborhoods first, whether that's in our, you know, BIPOC communities or in communities that are working class, working poor, and have been carrying that burden for all too long.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so glad that Maria decided to have this particular topic when we talked about the environment. I'm proud of the fact that my own organization, the National Lawyers Guild, and you may be aware of this, some decades ago in Detroit set up the Sugar Law Center, which was aimed at exactly that kind of that side of the coin, the business of justice, not having the dumps in all the poor neighborhoods, not having the poison lands in all the poor neighborhoods, and so forth. But we don't hear about that nearly enough. We hear about climate change. We hear about the big picture. But in the meanwhile, a lot of people are suffering unfairly and unjustly. And of course, we also know there are people who deny the very fact of climate change. Are there also people, Angelo, who also deny that there's environmental injustice as well? Do they deny that as well or not?
Yeah, I would say yes. That's been my experience. And as you said, there's many people's opinion and, you know, the way that they kind of think about these issues. But I have run up against folks that will straight out, you know, claim that environmental racism doesn't exist, regardless of the amount of data and research that has proven it time and time again. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, there are some affluent neighborhoods or communities that are not majority people of color, don't have some issues and are carrying some burdens and, you know, maybe even hot spots when it comes to exposure to toxins. But, you know, the majority of the toxic communities across the country and the globe are really in working class, working poor communities of color. And that's, I think, at least from my perspective, without a doubt, has been proven time and time again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Angelo, let's talk about the power of people locally. Local power, people power. You started your activism as a grassroots community organizer here in Los Angeles, I remember. What neighborhoods did you spend most of your time in, speaking of the Los Angeles region? What were the community's most pressing concerns back then, and what are they now?
Yeah, well, thank you for reminding me of this kind of, you know, couple of decades in the work that I've been involved in and actually had the pleasure of working with you on as well. You know, I grew up in the city of Commerce, which is a neighborhood in Southeast LA, actually kind of just, you know, right on the kind of verge of East Los Angeles. I spent, you know, most of my childhood in East LA and City of Commerce and Southeast LA. And I grew up in the City of Commerce, kind of, you know, the name kind of speaks for itself, right? And so an industrial core, like, you know, of Los Angeles, a lot of manufacturing, a lot of chemical manufacturing and transportation, and a lot of industries that are harmful to the environment and to public health. In early 2000 or 2000, I should say, there was a shift of the type of industry that was coming out of the City of Commerce in East LA, shifting from manufacturing to the movement of goods out of Southeast Los Angeles. And so, I'm sorry, Southeast Asia and through the ports of LA, and the shipment of those goods via trucks and trains throughout the region created what we'd call a diesel magnet or diesel hotspot. And over the years, people have started to call these places like Wilmington and Commerce and Southeast LA and Riverside and San Bernardino diesel death zones. And actually, that was really my experiences that, you know, growing up in that neighborhood and at that time when that shift happened, we've seen an influx of diesel pollution from the movement of goods, you know, with trucks, trains, and equipment. This increase of diesel pollution to the point where there was a cancer cluster in my neighborhood and on our block. And so that really motivated me to get involved and engaged, and have been working on that issue since then. And so that is what prompted, you know, the kind of work that I've started to do and organize with my neighbors. And I would say that still, you know, if not the number one issue in the region, it's up there, you know, in the top tier. Diesel pollution is a carcinogen. It's also black carbon, which adds to climate pollution. And there's many issues that come along with diesel pollution. And so there's been an effort to transition diesel-powered engines to zero-emission technology. With that, there also brings new problems, right? And so not to say that, you know, there isn't other issues, but this is one of the big issues. And in the City of Commerce in Southeast LA, the other big issue is kind of like an umbrella issue, which is cumulative impacts, meaning that there's accumulation of many sources of pollution, you know, whether it's ambient lead ambient lead, or whether it's contaminated groundwater in, you know, under your homes and parks, or whether it's a chemical facility, you know, that's releasing toxins, or whether it's a trash incinerator that's releasing dioxins. These are, you know, real factors and real issues in the communities that I grew up in. And there's been a lot of progress. You know, we've seen the shutting down of the trash incinerator in Commerce. And we've seen the transition of diesel trucks, but much more work needs to be done. I mean, the amount of traffic and the amount of industry is so immense that there's lots of work to be done. And I'll say that, you know, going into this idea of people power, you know, this started, my work started on my block, right? That's where it started for me. So you can't really get much more local than that. And so as we do, as we, you know, started to really just, you know, walk the blocks and door to door and, you know, engage with our neighborhood and our neighbors and our community and our mentors and our, you know, aunts and uncles and so on and so forth. And that turned into organized effort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with that organized effort, then starting to connect with other organizations and communities to then build a stronger kind of movement towards justice, and specifically environmental justice, really centered around our health, right? And so this idea of, you know, starting local, and I mentioned earlier that the climate crisis starts in our neighborhoods. And if we're going to resolve the climate crisis, we got to resolve it first in our neighborhoods. And that's where also the power lies. And as we think about all of the issues that may arise, whether they're, you know, assaults from, you know, as the climate crisis kind of bears down on us, or whether they're specific attacks from, you know, big players in, you know, whether it's through policy or through industry, that local communities are the safety net for their neighborhoods. And so you know, it's a matter of us being able to build the resiliency and the ability to look out for each other. And the power is not in, you know, we want to work towards systemic change. We want to work towards a real democracy. But at the end of the day, we have to depend on ourselves to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves. And that's about building community. And when we work towards building community, we build that kind of self-reliance, but also the power to make real change happen, whether that's in our community or, you know, this local city council or the state government, and then leveraging that to the federal government and hopefully beyond.
Well, I was going to say, because people think of climate change first and foremost, they don't, before maybe they think of climate environmental justice, you know, oh, it's so overwhelming. What can I do? I recycle. What else can I do? I got a hybrid car. But what else can I do? That notion, though, I think what you've shown is that building that kind of power within the community itself over some issue may be a global issue, but it's also impacting them in a very special, unjust way. And so by working on that, they kind of, you kind of break through that notion that it's beyond us. It's something only up to governments and the people meeting in, you know, at the GOP, whatever it is now, 106 or whatever it is. But I was wondering, Angel, as your influence has grown, you've been called upon, we've mentioned this, I think, public policy advisors, local, state, federal levels. You served as the environmental justice advisory boards for both the South Coast Air Quality Management District and for the White House. So you mentioned diesel fuel, certainly. But what are, would you say, are some of the biggest environmental and climate justice issues that the state of California faces at the moment? And who are some of the members of the state legislature or organizations that are most intelligently working on those biggest issues?
It's hard to identify like the big issues because, you know, all the issues are very important. Yeah. But I'll name a couple as an example. But like I said, there's so many that are people are like facing that are really life and death situations. Gotcha. You know, whether they're legacy pollution that folks have been dealing with because of, you know, the military kind of dumping of toxins, or whether it's landfill issues, are living near, you know, power generators, or and really working towards, you know, transitioning away from the type of energy production that we are wanting to move towards, to both address the climate crisis as well as environmental justice or environmental racism. So, you know, in terms of power production, I think that our energy production, I think that that's a major issue that we need to continue to really work towards. And, you know, the state of California has developed a goal towards moving away from fossil fuel and into renewable energy. I think that there's a need to be more aggressive in that regard, to be work in a faster way so that we can really avoid a even more of a crisis than what we see coming down the pipe.
Is that something where the federal government could stifle that effort under a Trump administration?
Or yeah, you know, part of the, yeah, I think part of what is how what would help the states, yeah, California and many other states, is the support from the federal government. And what we saw under the Biden administration was that, you know, there was both IRA and Bill, which are, you know, the bipartisan infrastructure bills that would help to support renewable energy. Okay. And, you know, we work towards advocating for a strong approach under the Biden administration. We'll continue to advocate for a strong approach under a new administration. So regardless of, you know, who's in office, environmental justice advocates are going to push hard, because we know we need to be very aggressive and progressive as it comes to transitioning. So, you know, I think energy is one, but there are others, such as, you know, food production, water access, and all of that is kind of, in my mind, kind of coupled into one of the issues that I think is top of mind for me, which is this move towards hydrogen hubs and carbon capture measures. And both of these both carbon capture and the hydrogen hubs are really, described as sustainable zero emission types of like approaches to addressing the climate crisis and energy production. But in reality, you know, there's many problems that come along with that. And there's lots of resources, lots of money that is going into the development of these. And even if there is a shift with the resources that are going towards sustainable energy production, I think that there will continue to be energy or, you know, resources and attention towards these hydrogen hubs. And the big red flag with these hydrogen hubs proposals, and especially in California, is that the process is not transparent, and the information and data is not available to the public. Being involved in development of these projects, engaged in these projects, if they're to come towards in your neighborhood, you know, you want to be involved. But to be involved, there is an NDA that's involved in participating in these projects. And when you ask for the data in terms of what are the air quality impacts, that information is not revealed and not available. So that's already a red flag in terms of like whether or not this is a project that folks would be supportive of. And, you know, one of the cornerstones to environmental justice is self-determination. How might you determine whether or not this project is beneficial to your community that you can support it if you have no information, or if you're unable to share the information by signing an NDA? So that's one huge one. And it really speaks to, you know, the democracy piece and the self-determination piece of our work in California and beyond. So that's one big flag.
All right.
And yeah, that has, again, implications related to water, related to food, related to energy, and even our transition towards zero emission transportation.
That makes sense.
It's an interesting issue about the NDAs and especially investors and people as we privatize these things, water and probably air someday. But I do worry about that and reminding people to demand accountability from their government officials. Which, speaking of government officials, I'd like to now turn to the federal government. And as a reminder to listeners, I'm Maria Hall here with co-host Jim Lafferty. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. We're speaking with Angelo Logan. So, Angelo, so do you know yet, I hate to ask you this, but do you know yet whether the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Board will continue with the next administration?
Yeah, well, can I just first start by saying that, you know, I at Liberty Hill, we're a nonpartisan 501c3 nonprofit organization, and meaning, you know, we work towards justice regardless of who's in office, what party is in office, and would continue to do it regardless of who was elected and who will be elected in the next term as well. But saying that, you know, the information that, from my perspective, that I'll be sharing is really based on the stated policies and positions that the folks that have been elected, you know, whether it's, you know, federal representatives or senators are in the White House. And we know that we've heard these stated kind of positions that that there isn't a lot of support around the environment. There isn't a lot of support around environmental justice. And as a matter of fact, there's been a number of reports that have come out that really target environmental justice work and really consider that to be a partisan issue, that environmental justice is a partisan issue. We don't see it that way. But as you know, it's articulated in that way. You know, I believe that our days are numbered in terms of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. But you know, we'll continue to do our good work. We are planning to have a public meeting to kind of continue to provide our recommendations from the Advisory Council to the White House, and we'll continue to do that work until we're told that our work is not needed. And so I expect that probably in the coming months that, you know, our council may dissolve, but we won't know until we know.
Well, right. And it's a great roster anyway, yes. And you all know each other.
Yeah. So. Yes, definitely. That's helpful. But yeah, I was just sitting here as I was listening to, especially in this last question. I mean, it's certainly easy to forget one administration or another. I mean, the fact of the matter is we're still piping more greenhouse gases every year than we did the year before, despite little changes here and there. Things are getting worse. We're reaching tipping points we never heard of before. I mean, you don't have to be in America and worrying about who the next administration is to feel awfully damn depressed about the climate and about environmental justice, as you brilliantly pointed out. So it's easy to get disheartened when you hear this kind of news. Now we're facing, admittedly, here in this country, four more, I think, going to be very bad years for the kind of work you've been so heroically and others have been so heroically doing. But you've been fighting these David and Goliath battles your whole life. So I guess I'm wondering, what might your message be? How do you manage to stay energized anyway, to stay optimistic despite what may be a big bump in the road now? And what would you say to our listeners to make sure that they continue to be a part of this movement?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned the work around environmental justice is local work. And that local work is about community building, right? And I think that, you know, one of the things that I see as the pathway forward is that it's about sharing information and building community to realize self-determination and connect with other communities to work towards a stronger democracy. And the way that we do that is not the same way that, you know, I think the general public has been kind of absorbing information, which is through, you know, corporate media and so forth, but really about us connecting with each other and building that community and finding the joy in the work and in the connection through our cultures and through our practices. And that is what inspires me when I engage with, you know, folks. Now I have the opportunity to engage with community partners across LA County, and not just in the local organization that I'm working with, but every time I engage with folks across the county and the region, that's inspiring to be in community with folks that are motivated and will continue to do the work and are doing that work locally to support each other. Be that safety net for each other, and then building that outwards towards, you know, a movement of sorts. And that's inspiring. I think, you know, I kind of like think about this approach towards, or this thought on hope and what hope is from like a kind of a science kind of perspective, and that hope is the idea that people can make the change they want to see, and that's based on setting goals, identifying a pathway, and that those goals and that work is motivating enough that people will take action. And so when you see these different kinds of like the goals and the pathway, and that gives you hope because you see kind of like you see the light at the end of the tunnel, you see a pathway forward. And I do believe that our movement, our work, you know, we have goals, we stand on very, you know, solid principles, and people are working and building community. And that gives me hope. And every time I walk away from, you know, the community, you know, work, we, you know, that it just re-energizes me myself. So,
yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. And of course, having people like you as examples, you know, for the kids, that's also very inspiring. I'll just say that. And yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we do want to get in. How can people find out more about your work? And what are some of the other orgs where they can go for information and to plug in?
Yeah, well, I would love to direct people to the Liberty Hill Foundation website. You know, we are a local justice foundation, and we work with many, many community organizations. So, use us as a vehicle to connect you to the organizations, find out about the work that we're doing, you know, sign up for our on our contact list. And, you know, if you're so inclined, you know, become a donor activist, you know, sign up to engage and support the work that's on the ground, and also engage with those local organizations that are close to you or close to your heart.
Awesome. Well, Jim, you want to?
Well, no, I just, I'm sorry, we have to move on here. Well,
it's just, I know.
It's just wonderful that your work is so inspiring. I know you're going to keep on. I know we're going to have you back on from time to time to talk about the various projects, because we're certainly not going to sleep here for the next 4 years in California. I know you're not. So we want to try to give you as much attention as we can. Thank you for today. People can go, what is your website again, where you'd recommend people go? The Liberty Hill or whichever one you want to give out.
Liberty Hill Foundation.
Liberty Hill Foundation. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Now we're going to take a very brief station ID, my friends. We'll be back with you very, very quickly, so don't go anywhere.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind & Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
We are back, as promised, very quickly. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show here on KPFK. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall. And now we're about to go into one of the promises that Mr. Trump has made for his second administration. Listeners, listen, President-elect Trump has made it, well, he's made his plans very clear in a lot of ways, but he certainly made it clear when it comes to how he's going to deal with unwanted political protests. And there aren't many political protests unless they favor him that he wants, including those, of course, against his administration. He said it loud and clear many, many times, including at a rally last year when he said, and I quote, "The next time I'm not waiting," close quote, meaning before committing military troops to suppress the protests. He's also made it just as clear that he's not going to hesitate to call out the National Guard or military troops where law and order has, in his judgment, broken down in some city or town, thereby requiring the intervention of outside military policing in the city. And to use military troops, of course, to carry out his massive plan to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. And with that recent Supreme Court opinion, giving him a, well, virtual blank check to do whatever he wants to do as part of his presidential duties, we can count on him doing what he has threatened to do. Still, is calling out the U.S. military to take action on U.S. soil against U.S. people truly legal? What about a big and boisterous political protest that, well, like any large protest, can be temporarily disruptive to civic life? Is that enough? What about the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? Well, to help us unravel the legalities and illegalities underlying this frightening prospect, awaiting us under Trump's second administration, we're fortunate to have as our guest again today, Professor Marjorie Cohn. Now, Professor Cohn is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She is the former president, I'm proud to say, of the National Lawyers Guild, an advisory board member of the wonderful Veterans for Peace, and she is the founding dean of the People's Academy of International Law. Professor Cohn's books include Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much, Jim and Maria.
Yeah, in fact, I should say that today's topic was inspired by an article, of course, that you wrote and you do all the time in truthout.org entitled, "Trump Isn't Hiding Plan to Use Military to Quash Protests and Deport Immigrants." So my first question, I guess, is this, Marjorie. Your article claims that employing federal troops to suppress domestic protests and deport immigrants from the U.S. and Hamas would be illegal. So first, give us a bit of a lecture on the various laws and legal principles supporting that notion that that is illegal, as you say. Talk to us first about that, and then we'll take a look at what Trump intends to do about it.
Well, the Posse Comitatus Act, which was enacted in 1878 to end the use of federal troops in overseeing elections in the post-Civil War South, bars the use of the military to enforce domestic laws, and that includes immigration law. The act forbids the willful use of any part of the Army, Navy, Marine, Air Force, or Space Force as a posse comitatus, or power of the county, or otherwise to execute the laws. Now, there are some exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act's prohibition, and that is when expressly authorized by the Constitution or an act of Congress. Uh-huh. So the Insurrection Act, which was passed by Congress, carves out an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act. The Insurrection Act can be used to authorize the president to deploy U.S. armed forces, federalize the National Guard, or deputize private militias of non-governmental forces within the United States. And think about that, private militias of non-governmental forces. You know what that might be. Just think back to January 6th. Now, there are three sections of the Insurrection Act that the president could invoke, only one of which requires the consent of the officials of the state. The first is Section 251, which comes into play where the legislature or governor of a state specifically asks the president for assistance to quell an insurrection against the government. Secondly, Section 252 of the Insurrection Act says that where the president decides subjectively that unlawful obstructions, combinations, or assemblages or rebellion against the authority of the United States render it impracticable, whatever that means, to enforce U.S. or state law through the courts. And the third, which is Section 253, comes into play, the president can invoke it, when any insurrection, domestic violence, unlawful combination, or conspiracy deprives people of a legal right, privilege, immunity, or protection that results in the denial of equal protection, or opposes or obstructs the execution of the laws of the United States, or impedes the course of justice under those laws. Now, keep in mind that Section 252 of the Insurrection Act can be triggered just by the president's subjective belief that it's impracticable for the courts and the criminal legal system to function properly. And I'm sorry to say that many courts would hesitate to overrule a president's subjective decision. And particularly in light of the recent Supreme Court decision where the supermajority, right-wing supermajority, said that a president is absolutely immune from acts done in the course of his core official duties. So I just don't think the courts are going to save us from this. The Insurrection Act does not authorize the president to deploy federal troops on U.S. soil to restore public order.
No.
Well, Marjorie, is it not the case that past presidents have used some of the laws you mentioned to do the same or similar things in the face of actions they subjectively disapproved of that are taking place right here on U.S. soil? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Maria, most of the instances in which the Insurrection Act has been invoked occurred under Section 251. The act was last used in 1992. When then California Governor Pete Wilson asked President George H.W. Bush to deploy federal troops to put down the uprising against anti-Black racism and police brutality in Los Angeles following the state acquittal of the police officers who beat Rodney King. Section 253 of the Insurrection Act was enacted after the Civil War to ensure that Southern states enforced the federal rights of Black people. So it was used for a progressive purpose. President John F. Kennedy used Section 253 in 1962 and 1963 to send federal troops to Mississippi and Alabama to enforce the civil rights law. In 1957, President Dwight D. Eisenhower had deployed troops to desegregate schools in Little Rock, Arkansas. That was consistent with Section 253. And then in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson used Section 253 to protect civil rights demonstrators from police violence during the Civil Rights March from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie, I'm going to put two questions on the table. Well, let me put two questions on the table for you. First, you point out in your fine article, and I encourage our listeners, and we'll tell them more about it, but to go, you know, make sure you follow Marjorie on Truth Out. I mean, she writes wonderful stuff all the time. You're not going to find it anywhere else. It's understandable. It's written by a law professor, but you can be anybody and read it and understand what she's talking about. So, and you can't find it in the LA Times. So I would encourage you to do that. But let me get back to my question. You point out in the article that U.S. military personnel, of course, have the right to refuse to obey illegal orders. Yeah, but what is the chance of that happening, given the basically blank check the Supreme Court has given Trump? Because, after all, any soldier refusing to follow any orders risks the likelihood of being court-martialed, the action of the Trump found to be, you know, legal. So how likely is it also that the brass might refuse Trump's orders if they think it's wrong? And secondly, just to have it on the table too, but equally important question, I think, is this. Would it not be easy for any government experiencing a protest, city of Los Angeles, city of wherever, to plan in an otherwise large, boisterous, but peaceful protest? And I've seen it done right here in LA, a handful of undercover cops that could engage in illegal agitational actions designed to give the police an excuse. Next thing you know, you've got a Donnybrook on your hands and the president's calling in the police. I've seen that, as I say, happen here. And also outside agitators that haven't been prompted by the local authorities can turn a little part of a huge demonstration unpeaceful, and that would give them an excuse. So how do you see both of those issues, the military's handling of this and how easily it could be abused and give Trump a chance to do this sort of thing?
Well, Jim, Trump's threat to use military forces of the federal government domestically against protesters, immigrants, and other enemies, so-called enemies, places service members in a legal and ethical dilemma. Soldiers have not only a right but a duty to refuse illegal orders, and yet the legality of those orders would be determined when refusers are court-martialed. Yes. And service members have a moral obligation not to harm the innocent, but that harm would be inevitable if troops are used against civilians on U.S. soil. The Uniform Code of Military Justice requires that all military personnel obey lawful orders, but a law that violates the Constitution or a federal statute is an unlawful order. And both the Army Field Manual and the Nuremberg Principles create a duty to disobey unlawful orders. Now, I want to be kind of specific here for a minute, and I'm drawing on a chapter in the book that I co-authored with Kathy Gilbert, who's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild's Military Law Task Force, and our book is called Rules of Disengagement: The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent. And in 2004, U.S. Navy Petty Officer Third Class Pablo Paredes refused orders to deploy to Iraq. He believed the war in Iraq was illegal and that service members who fought in Iraq would be placed in a position to commit war crimes, torture, inhuman treatment, willful killing, denial of right to fair trial, etc., war crimes, which are listed in the Geneva Conventions. And by delivering Marines to Iraq, Pablo Paredes felt he would be complicit as a war criminal. So the Navy charged him with unauthorized absence and missing his ship's movement by design. The judge in his special court-martial dismissed the unauthorized absence charge, but convicted him of missing movement by design. The judge refused to allow expert testimony on the illegality of the Iraq War in the guilt phase of the court-martial, but he permitted me to testify as an expert witness in the sentencing hearing. And I told the judge that the war in Iraq violated the UN Charter, which forbids a country from attacking another country unless it's acting in self-defense or the with the approval of the Security Council. Neither of those things was present. Therefore, the Iraq War was illegal. And I also explained that Pablo Paredes had a reasonable belief that transporting Marines to Iraq would put them in the position, and him by association, of committing war crimes. Well, at the conclusion of my testimony, annoyed with the inept cross-examination by a Navy prosecutor, the judge made a statement that astonished the spectators. He said, and I quote, "I believe the government has successfully demonstrated a reasonable belief for every service member to decide that the wars in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Iraq were illegal to fight in." Everybody was just astounded. The judge didn't sentence Pablo to any jail time or give him a bad conduct discharge for missing his ship's movement to the Persian Gulf. He gave him 2 months restriction to the base, 3 months of hard labor without confinement, and a reduction in rank to seaman recruit. Spectators on both sides of the aisle were stunned at the leniency of the sentence.
Let me just say, Bargetts, I mean, my hat's off to you. I remember when that happened, and anybody who thinks it would have turned out that way had you not been there is whistling Dixie or whatever the damned expression is. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was quite an experience. And then I also want to mention the case of Aaron Watada. In 2006, U.S. Army First Lieutenant, and we're talking an officer here, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada became the first commissioned officer to publicly disobey an order to deploy to Iraq. He said he believed the war was illegal and that under the doctrine of command responsibility, it would make him a party to war crimes. Basically, if a commander knows or should have known that a subordinate would be committing war crimes and does nothing to stop it, then he or she can be liable under command responsibility. So Watada was brought before a court-martial in 2007, which did not allow any expert testimony, including by me, and it ended in a mistrial. The Army subsequently discharged Aaron Watada under other than honorable conditions in 2009. Now, military courts are not enthusiastic about challenges to the legality of orders or the wars or their constitutional and international law underpinnings. With little testimony and argument about these issues, some testimony and argument has been used in the defense phase of courts martial, but it's usually presented as part of other arguments that challenge the intent and motivation elements of the charged offenses. And while military judges are generally unwilling to grapple with international law and the constitutionality of military orders as a defense, or admit that the military may have got it wrong on the law, some judges have been sympathetic to these arguments as issues of mitigation in sentencing, such as in Pablo's case. In some courtrooms, resistors have been treated with a degree of respect, and sentences sometimes reflect this. But this approach can backfire. There's always a risk that soldiers arguing the illegality of the war as a defense may receive harsher treatment, and certainly military courts have been more lenient towards quiet soldiers with family or medical problems than people speaking out publicly from personal beliefs. Like civilian courts, military courts martial are influenced indirectly by popular opinion about the legality of the wars and the courage of the resistors. And the illegality of the wars, and they all have been illegal, by the way, the illegality of the wars has had a significant effect on the course of public opinion.
I'm interrupting you only because there's so damn much to cover always in so little time. And I do want to give you a chance if you're interested in that second question I asked too, because that's apt to be where it manifests most often. You're going to have a large demonstration. Maybe there's 5,000 people. They're all peaceful, but 20 people decide to throw water bottles at the cops. Maybe they're outside agitators. Who knows who they are? The point is it gives the police an excuse to want to shut down the whole thing. which of course we know they shouldn't be doing. They should simply separate those who are violating the law. But doesn't that kind of thing then, and in some cities they'll act one way about it, some in others. LA is a result of the Lawyers Guild, and others are behaving a little differently maybe. But I can imagine cities jumping on that chance. Next thing you know, there's basically a riot because of what they're doing to peaceful protesters. Trump can jump in a minute. That's the excuse he's looking for, not that he really needs one. Are you worried about that, and is there anything to be done about that?
Yes, I am worried about it, Jim. I mean, that's a real danger. They call them agent provocateur.
Yes.
We saw them in the 60s during the anti-war movement. There would be a peaceful protest, and then people, and usually agent provocateurs are people who have some kinds of personal problems, and they are recruited, or their weaknesses are played upon by the authorities, and then that gives the authorities a so-called excuse to move in. And not that Trump needs any excuse in his mind. I mean, he's we could go on forever and talk about how Trump is threatening to do illegal things. He does it all the time. And he will. The problem with his second term is that they're much more organized now. They have Project 2025. They've got their ducks in a row. They've got all of these outrageous cabinet picks. I'm just afraid that the Democrats are just going to wimp out. We'll see what happens. But I just think that the best way to try to avoid this is organizing and using the National Lawyers Guild, the legal observers with our, green hats and the armbands to witness police misconduct, and also to witness these so-called agent provocateurs.
Yeah. Whatever we've got to do. It's like I remember during the Patriot Act, people kept saying, well, Jim, what should I do? I said, you should speak against the Patriot Act. If you let this act win before you've even tried, you're obviously defeated. The people have got to keep demonstrating, and there'll be all the more reasons to demonstrate in this next appearance. And the Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, there are any number of wonderful organizations that will be backing you up when you do. Don't be frightened off the streets. Don't let that puff of wind scare you off the streets. Yeah, he's going to try all sorts of things. But numbers, peaceful, get out there and fight back. And I know that the Guild will be there with you. I promise you that, my friends. It's an easy promise to make. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Maria. You have a question.
Yes, I do. And I was going to add that Trump has a way of offending everyone around him. So even by his Secretary of Defense pick, I think he really insulted the military. So if he intends to use them, I don't think he's making any friends right now. But all that said, okay, so Marjorie Cohen, in April of this year, at the invitation of the American Law Institute, a bipartisan group of professors and former officials of both Obama and Bush administrations studied all of this and proposed amending the Insurrection Act because it currently, gives the president a lot of power. How did they propose to amend the act?
Well, I'll tell you that, but I also want to tell you that many experts are saying that it should be read narrowly as it is. Is not to have constitutional problems, but there is these principles for Insurrection Act reform that you're referring to. There was agreement on both sides of the aisle that the Insurrection Act gives any president too much unchecked power. So this bipartisan group proposed amending the Insurrection Act to say that the president cannot deploy the armed forces unless the violence is such that it overwhelms the capacity of federal, state, and local authorities to protect public safety and security. So the main points of reform proposed by this bipartisan group are, first, require the president to consult with the governor before deploying troops into any state. Require the president to report to Congress within 24 hours of deployment about the need to invoke the Insurrection Act and about any consultations he has had with state authorities. Limit the president's authority to deploy troops under the act to a maximum of 30 days unless Congress renews the authorization, and establish a fast-track process for Congress to vote on renewal of presidential authority under the Insurrection Act. But one real problem is that these principles for Insurrection Act reform state that the Insurrection Act need not and should not include a provision for judicial review. This is probably a compromise reached chief bipartisan consensus. That's a real problem with these.
Any chance that, because we are just about out of time, and I want to give you a chance to say something else too, but any chance that those reforms will find their way into law, do you think, realistically or not?
I'm afraid they won't. There is a bill pending in the Senate, Blumenthal introduced. It does contain a provision for judicial review. But I think particularly now, everybody is afraid of Trump and the judges in his various criminal cases and his 91 criminal charges, 34 convictions, et cetera, are running as fast as they can to wimp out on it.
I know.
After dragging years and years.
Before we are out of time, I want you, any quick last thought, but also where can people, I've tried to mention, where do people follow your writing, which they should be doing? They're going to learn so much during this next period of time that I'm telling you, you're not going to learn anywhere else, folks, or it's not going to be easy to find anywhere else. This is the easy way to do it. Tell our listeners where they can do that, Marjorie, first.
Well, thank you so much for your kind words, Jim. And I write a regular column called Human Rights and Global Wrongs for Truth Out. If you go on truthout.org, go to the very bottom, you'll see Human Rights and Global Wrongs. You click on that. My articles are there. Also, they're collected on my website, along with blurbs about my books and videos and interviews, called MarjorieCohn.com.
I think we may have, 30 seconds left? It's hard to know. Your last thought, Marjorie?
My last thought is that we are really in for a dangerous period. And I think that it's important for people. Everybody is depressed. Not everybody, but, progressive-minded people are depressed. And I think it's important to keep our heads out of the sand and as in Dare to Struggle, Dare to Win. And as Joe Hill said, don't mourn, organize. We have to resisting against what is to come, the fascism that is.
Yes. We've had McCarthy periods. We've had, oh, my God, all sorts of periods in this country, my friends. We've overcome them. We can overcome this one, too. He ain't that tough. But at any rate, Marjorie Cohn, as always, thank you. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild show. Maria, you and I think, did a good show today. I love these guests. They were just absolutely wonderful. We encourage you to join us next week. We'll promise you another good show for next week as well. Until then, this is Jim Lafferty urging you to, stay healthy at all costs and stay active and stand up for your rights, my friends.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. Life is really worth. It's an art that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
KPFK invites you to tune into The Global Village, weekdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., bringing you a global mix of hosts seeking the universal soul and making musical connections between our geographical and musical cultures. That's The Global Village, KPFK's flagship music program, with new and familiar voices, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right here on 90.7 FM, and online at kpfk.org.
All of the above, 2 to 4, and then Saturday night.
Okay, I know it's late, but sometimes you just get inspired to rock, right?
Yeah. I did.
All
All of the above radio, growing on the west coast of the Milky Way, with your host Bango, in rare form as usual, Buddle synthesizing right before your eyes.
So show your appreciation!
Yeah. Light year groove.
A journey through high quality music that's always fun.